Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So hello from Cape Town, another episode of the Science of Sport podcast with myself, Mike Finch, and Professor Ross Tucker. And to keep up with the theme that we've had since our last podcast, if you can call it a theme, we're going to be talking all about lungs and lung function today. Last week we had a very interesting discussion with an allergologist who talked about allergies and the prevalence of allergies amongst athletes. So you can have a look at that if you haven't heard that already. And today we have somebody who's going to be taking us through some very interesting, first of all, exercises and some of the theory and some of the practice, the practical stuff around breathing, and somebody who works with athletes, both novice and elites. But before we get to that, another caught my eye from Ross, who's been keeping a close eye on some of the stuff on Patreon. Don't forget, you can support us on Patreon. That's if you go to patreon.com, that's P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com, and have a look for Science of Sport. You can spot us on there. And if you feel like supporting us and you like what we do, you can donate any amount of money depending on which level you want to be part of. And you can be part of our Patreon community, which means you can ask questions, you can get involved in some of the discussions that are having on our Patreon channel. And I know that Ross is very active on that channel, so you can interact with Ross with some of the stuff outside of the podcast.
Yeah, but very active. I'm trying to be disciplined about setting aside a morning a week, because I get this backlog of messages and comments that you make, and then I try to keep up as much as possible. And what we do is we pick one a week of something that's caught your eye, and then we discuss it here on the podcast. So if you sign up, that's one of the perks. Plus, I am committing to replying to all of you eventually in writing.
Whether you know what you normally do there.
I try my best, but my admin skills are not superior. This week's caught my eye, though, comes from Craig Farrell, who messaged over the weekend. This would now be, when you're listening to this, 2 weekends back. And he was watching the boxing, Anthony Joshua's defeat at the weekend in Saudi Arabia. And during the undercard, there was a fight between Zhang and Hrugovic, where the commentators kept talking about the fighter getting his second wind. So Craig writes in, he says, "We hear about second wind a lot in sport, but is it an actual physiological phenomenon? If so, could you explain it in terms of what's happening cardiovascularly, please? Is adrenaline a consideration? Is it more of a mental thing linked to momentum of a fight? Or is it a myth that commentators like to talk about, but isn't based on any evidence or science?" So that's a good one. I mean,
I have no idea about that question.
Time, so. In your time in Runner's World, have you not done second wind articles ever?
I think it probably have, but if you had to ask me that question first up, I wouldn't know what the answer to that is. I know that I've probably experienced it to some extent, because you definitely go through sort of valleys and heights if you're doing an endurance race or even just a morning Sunday ride, where you sometimes get a second wind and sometimes even a third wind. So, but yeah, I certainly haven't thought about it as a wind.
Yeah, and I heard the term long before I experienced the term, but everyone has. The thing about it is, I think that it's used as a catch-all to describe any one of 5 or 6 different phenomena. And generally what it means is, I feel better now doing the same thing I was doing a few minutes ago. That's all it is.
Yeah, that's quite a good way of, sort of, way of putting it.
And if you understand it to be that, then it could be literally anything. I mean, if you run a 10K or a marathon at 35K, let's say marathon, 35K, you could feel like you're never going to see the finish line. At 41K, you're sprinting as fast as you can. You've run the same speed. In fact, at 41K, you've incurred more damage and metabolic cost than you had at 35, yet you feel better. That's a second wind. Now, that's a second wind.
Or it's a finishing burst.
That's a second wind created entirely by the psychological or the intellectual knowledge that the finish line's close.
Yeah.
So that's the end spurt. That's the governor, anticipatory regulation, whatever you want to call it. So that's one explanation for a second wind. Another explanation is, you fail to eat well enough before a ride or run, and you stop for a break, or you have luckily some sports drink or energy available on the bike or run, and you take it and you feel better. Mm. That's a second one created by the sudden arrival of fuel that you needed and didn't have before, right? So there's that. There's also probably one of the theories is the old runner's high, which I'll be honest, I never experienced. The best I ever felt running was normal, never high. Did you ever have a high?
Absolutely. I completely believe in the runner's high.
I couldn't ever get high running, that's for sure.
Yeah, but you experience it in very different. I've experienced it in both in cycling and running, where you get to that space where your just body seems to be purring. It's the only way I can describe it, where you're just purring. When you can be on the bike, you can feel it. You can be on the runway. It's just that moment. And sometimes it's only a minute or two in a 10K run where you just feel everything is working at the optimum.
Yeah, I felt that. I'm not sure it qualifies as the end. So the old runner's high is the endorphin release and these natural opiates that your body generates that then act centrally to give you a feeling of euphoria.
So it is a thing.
I can't say I've had that euphoria. I felt good. Normally going downhill.
Maybe your euphoria isn't as euphoric as other people's euphoria.
Maybe, yeah. Like I say, at best I got to normal. Anyway, back to Craig's question. So that's one of the theories for the second wind. Now, academically, when you go into any academic search engine and you look for second wind exercise, you will learn all about a very interesting metabolic condition called McArdle disease. It's literally the first thing. If you go on PubMed, for instance, which is a search engine, you say second wind exercise, you will find dozens of articles describing a second wind phenomenon in McArdle disease. Now, McArdle disease is a condition where you lack the important enzyme that breaks glycogen down. So you remember in your, in fact, we've discovered this in some of our podcasts, is that your muscle stores glycogen. Mm-hmm. And in order to convert that glycogen to eventually ATP for fuel, you have to first break it down into glucose and then pyruvate and then all the other metabolic processes.
Insulin's a part of that process, isn't it? Where you have to have a whole bunch of systems in place to be able to use the available energy.
Well, that's insulin's more on the storage side. So when you consume carbohydrates, you've got to get it into the storage compartment, i.e. muscle. Mm. And insulin helps the glucose get from the circulation into the muscle cell.
Yeah.
Then it's stored as glycogen and we break it down when we need it during exercise. Now, what these McArdle disease patients have is the inability to break down glycogen. So they have severe exercise intolerance because they cannot metabolize glycogen. Now, and when it's really interesting, I remember learning this in my undergraduate, these people at exhaustion have got no lactate at all. They exhaust or fatigue in the absence of lactate.
Sure.
And their exercise capacity is astonishingly low. I mean, some of the studies, they reach fatigue at 30 to 50 watts on a bicycle, which is, I mean, that's like soft pedaling on a no chain day. Because they just cannot convert glycogen into glucose and then eventually into pyruvate. Okay. Now, what happens in these patients is that when they exercise, for the first 5 to 7 minutes, their RPE is exceptionally high. Heart rates are exceptionally high. And they are severely exercise intolerant. But if they can push through that, then after about 6-7 minutes, suddenly their rating of perceived exertion drops. Their heart rate comes right down. Their ability to continue exercise improves, and they can go for 20 minutes at the same power output that 3 or 4 minutes before was about to cause them to stop. So that is a classic second wind phenomenon. And what's happening there is that it takes time for the fuel stores not in the muscle to reach the muscle. So let's call them extra muscle, outside the muscle fuel. So we're talking now from the liver, glucose, and we're talking from the fat cells, fatty acids. It takes a while, a period of time, for our bodies to get that glucose from the liver to the muscle and from the adipose tissue, the fatty acids, to the muscle. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
And that's why when you get to 7-8 minutes, these people suddenly develop the capacity to exercise where a minute before they were on the verge of quitting.
Wow. Okay.
Because there's a metabolic lag in how quickly it gets there. And I mean, there's a paper here, and again, show notes for everyone. This is from the Journal of the American Medical Association. They describe in this paper an example. And I want to read this to you. It's fascinating. Let me just see if I can find this. Typical exercise response. Peak work at 7 minutes was 30 watts. I mean, that's barely even pedaling. Yeah. With a heart rate of 172, close to maximum for this person. As the workload was reduced between minutes 8 and 10, The patient experienced the onset of a second wind marked by decreasing exercise effort. It was now it feels much less hard and a falling heart rate. By minute 12, the 30 watt workload was easily tolerated and the heart rate was now 126. So it went from 172 to 126 at the same workload. And the heart rate was then stable for the next 5 minutes. And then they increased the workload to 55, so nearly double, corresponding to a heart rate of 171. So they got this person to twice the workload at the same heart rate.
Yeah.
And that's because all of a sudden, in the absence of glycogen, severe intolerance initially. But once the, let's call it the backups, once the backups arrive, it starts to get a bit better. Now, elite boxers, when you're watching on television, don't have this condition.
No.
But there is a theory that a similar phenomenon might explain from a metabolic perspective, the second wind in healthy people, where initially, as we move from rest into exercise, we rely very heavily on muscle glycogen. But over time, particularly once I reach a sort of steady state, the fatty acid stores and the liver glucose or glycogen gets converted into glucose, they arrive at the level of them at the muscle, and all of a sudden we can start relying on oxidative stores. And so then the lactate levels will stabilize, the acidosis levels will stabilize, and we will suddenly start feeling better than we had a few moments before. So that's the metabolic theory for second wind.
So in other words, there obviously is a physiological process that does happen that gives credence to the whole idea of a second wind then.
Yes. Now, it's you know, McArdle disease is one of those examples where if you want to know how something works, you study when it fails.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a really good model to understand glycogen metabolism because these individuals just cannot use their own glycogen. It's astonishing. Mm. Their lactate levels, as I say, they actually go down when they start exercising, not up like most people's.
And if you talk to a lot of like endurance athletes, they'll almost inevitably tell you, whether they're elite or backmarkers or just good age groupers, that they go through ups and downs during the period of a race, which means because nobody gets fueling 100% right. And I imagine also psychologically, there's also the psychological factors in that second wind. When you're close to the finish, you feel there's so many things.
And there'll be hormonal as well. You know, we spoke a couple podcasts back about training zones, and, you know, the steady state zone is defined almost as the upper end of zone two is the hardest I can go before I lose my ability to maintain steady state.
Mm.
Below that, we can have steady state levels, but initially, it's uncomfortable and it takes our bodies a little while, hormonally, cardiovascularly. We've got to get signals to all the different parts of the body. We've got to get blood distributed where it's needed. We have to release hormones that will make the heart contract more forcefully and strongly. Our ventilation rate has to go up, and initially it probably lags behind demand. So there's a period during which we're spending more than we have available, but we catch up to that, and that's why we reach steady state. And I think that's probably what a lot of people, not confused, but attributes a second wind to. It's like, this was uncomfortable for 10 minutes, but once I got into it, I felt actually pretty good. And getting into it is colloquialism for my physiology caught up to the demands. Now, again, McArdle's is an extreme version of this phenomenon, where it's not a switch that gets thrown, but very quickly they reach a point of tolerance where before they were failing. In healthy individuals, probably not quite as sudden, but the same phenomenon, or this, let put it this way, the same principles and concepts probably might explain that. So the answer to Craig's question is that there are physiological mechanisms, but the concept of a second wind is probably used as a catch-all for half a dozen of them.
Yeah. What's interesting, having done a few Ironman events, for instance, is that I'm always interested to know, and we see the advent of a lot of these glucose monitors now that you can buy and attach a patch to your arm and you can check where your glucose levels are. But you go through phases during a long distance event, whether it's a 100K cycle or an Ironman event, when you go through those dips and you think, when am I going to start feeling better? And I know sometimes we've been on a long ride and you stop for that red ambulance, that Coca-Cola with 30Ks to go, and you feel pretty terrible at that point, but you know and you trust that that sugar will get into your system and you're going to feel better 10, 15 minutes later.
And you do.
And you do. Mm. I often think when I'm in those real doldrums, I think to myself, how long is it going to take for this Coke to kick in?
Yeah, yeah.
And it does eventually. It takes a lot longer than you want it to.
Yeah.
But it does show you that you, what I'm interested and I wonder if there's, I'm sure there has been studies done, is how fast that catching up process can happen. I suppose a lot depends on, first of all, how depleted you are, and second of all, how much did you ingest to do the catching up.
Yeah, and so that will depend on many things: the intensity of exercise, the degree to which you've put yourself in a hole through not fueling sufficiently before, probably even stuff like your habitual diet. You know, some people will react quicker than others would. And so that's where it gets complicated. And just coming back to this McArdle patient, I was telling you the story a moment ago about a patient who then gets to 55 watts, heart rate of 171. What they then did here is they bombed in a small dose, 50 mils of sugar solution, dextrose specifically, and within a few minutes, the patients get another second wind, or an amplified second wind, where the heart rate now comes down to 147, and they can keep going for the next 5, 10, 15 minutes. So it's clear that fuel availability, both to the brain and the muscles, is one of the things that drives effort perception and thus second wind. But then so will hormone levels, so will respiration, because it's like there's a debt that we incur as we begin, and it takes a little while to pay that back. As long as we're in steady state intensities, we will pay that back, but how quickly is the function. And one trick, if you're ever out exercising and you do feel a little bit weak, lightheaded, and you think it's because your blood sugar is dropping, counterintuitively, a short sprint is one of the best ways to recorrect that, because when we go really hard, we drive our sympathetic nervous system and we get a little surge of adrenaline, and adrenaline mobilizes glycogen from the liver, and it puts it puts that glucose That's back into tip. The blood, and you can then get... So you wouldn't want to do that if you're an hour from your finish, because then you can accelerate the use of glucose and probably fail sooner. But if you know that there's a red ambulance, as you say, or something waiting for you over the next hill, a little surge... You know, and this incidentally, if you eat just before you exercise, sometimes you get a post-nutrition or post-eating drop in your blood glucose levels, and you maybe start exercising, you just feel really lethargic. A 15 to 20 second surge will give you just enough of a metabolic and a hormonal kick that you then get the blood glucose levels going back up, and That's you can finish the session. So, yeah, keep that in mind as an aside. But hopefully we've done a satisfactory job of answering Craig's question. And the bottom line is second wind is half a dozen things, but there are physiological mechanisms related to how much fuel I have available, where's the finish line. And then there's emotion. We haven't even touched on in a race situation. Emotion is massively important. I mean, you're commentating now the Comrades Ultra Marathon, even in a normal marathon.
Yeah.
The number of emotional highs and lows that then have physiological consequences is that's what racing is about.
The number of people who run their fastest mile or kilometer in the last 10Ks of an ultra is quite extraordinary. Yeah,
that's classic Enspeed phenomenon. Enspeed stuff, that's emotion and emotion, cognitive function. So there's that for the second wind as well. So it's a simple question with actually quite a complex and interesting answer. So thanks, Craig, for that. And
great
any
question.
Other patrons, if anything catches your eye, you post when I send out the links for the podcast, you can either post in response or you can just message the inbox and I will get to you in writing, and then one of you will be answered on the next show.
Yeah.
So go for it.
Great. So have a look at patreon.com and have a look for Science of Sport, and you'll be able to see us there quite easily. Right. So as promised, next up we have Samantha Holzhausen, who is a cardiopulmonary physiotherapist, and it's a very rare title for somebody who has given us a very interesting interview, and I'm sure you'll find that in the next half an hour to an hour, and talk specifically around breathing exercises and how the simple act of breathing can be changed and improved, even though we all think I'm doing pretty well already.
Yeah, and what's particularly rare is her application of that field. I know, especially in South Africa here, where you have a lot of tuberculosis, like physiotherapy in hospital settings is quite a big deal. And she started that way, but has now branched into working with athletes. She also works with people suffering or recovering from COVID and so on. But it's the athlete population that's most of interest to us. And I remember first hearing about her through some work with the South African Sevens rugby team. I used to be involved there, and the team doctor said to me that they'd worked with her. They were always innovative, looking for new things and new ways to do old things. And then one of our patron members, actually, who's an elite athlete, contacted me and said, hey, what about this person? So from two different sources, I figured it's a sign and let's get hold of it and talk. And it's just a fascinating area that is underappreciated because breathing is breathing, right? You all do it. No one ever taught you or needed to teach you. But in actual fact, this conversation will make you aware that it's not necessarily that simple. And there might be, even if it's not changes you make, just awareness that will enable you to perform slightly better by just being aware and understanding what happens when you breathe and how you can control it a bit more.
And I can guarantee you by the end of this interview, you will be breathing better. Here is Samantha Holzhausen.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So Sam, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. In your description on LinkedIn, it describes as a cardiopulmonary physiotherapist. Not something that you plan on when you're finishing school to become that, is it? I mean, it's not something you plan to do very early on in your medical career.
No, certainly not me. I was going to do physiotherapy all along, but it was going to be in the direction of sport because I've always loved sport. And then in the fourth year of my studies, we did a block in the intensive care unit and I just fell in love with the lungs and my direction promptly changed from then on. So it's been lungs ever since. Did my community service year in Port Elizabeth and then came back and did my master's in cardiorespiratory. And it's just been lungs ever since.
What about it made you fall in love with it doing ICU work?
I think for me, the biggest thing, because we were working in a state hospital in PE, and if your care is not good in the ICU, if you don't optimize that respiratory function in the ICU, I mean, what chance do you have after that of sort of regaining not a normal function, but a good respiratory function after that? So if your care can really be optimized in this critically ill setting, I mean, it just forms a foundation for better care and just an easier return to function after that. And it's difficult work. It's not for those who work in the intensive care unit. It's not easy work. But just optimizing those lungs in that critically ill space was a real inspiration.
What proportion of what you do now is ICU based as opposed to what you've taken away from that environment and applied in a non-ICU patient?
Yeah, so still very mixed. I still do a lot of critical care work and then a lot of work in the pulmonary rehabilitation sector. So we run a rehabilitation program for all patients with chronic respiratory conditions. So those waiting for lung transplants, anyone that's on oxygen, COPD, cystic fibrosis, any lung condition. So that's a huge part of my day. And then lately specialized in postgrad work in breathing dysfunction. So we'll see a lot of athletes with dysfunctional breathing patterns or exercise-induced asthma. And then patients who have no underlying lung pathology and they've just breathed their way into this terrible space. Because breathing in a bad way can elicit these terrible symptoms. Yeah. So those are kind of the cohorts that we see.
So breathing in a bad way is intriguing to me. That's a hook.
No one ever
taught me to breathe from the very first moment I entered the world. It's just been natural, right? But so it's interesting to me that you can breathe in a bad way. But before we get onto that, I know you're quite a keen adventure sport person, climbing, running, and so on. Did you come to an understanding of this stuff because you were aware of it in yourself, or did you learn it and then decide to think about it in yourself? Just out of interest, what's your experience of breathing as an athlete?
Yeah, I learn. The more I learn, the more I try to apply it to myself and my own running and on the trails, because I don't believe that you should give other athletes things to do if you haven't tried them out yourself. So I became intrigued with a lot of the principles that were being advised. I was like, let me give it a shot. And initially it was tough to change the way that you breathe while running. And now looking back, as climbing, we're doing a big climb on the weekend up Franschhoek, 6K climb to Paddlecore Peak. And I was doing the breathing as I do. And I was thinking, I can't actually believe I ever breathed in a way that wasn't like this.
And Is this something, I gather, that doesn't really exist in a curriculum anywhere? It's kind of like a few places around the world that do this, but it's not like you can find a textbook on this.
No. So a lot of postgrad studies, so we work with a Bradcliffe breathing group in New Zealand, and they opened up this entire breathing dysfunctional world to me, and it's been incredible learning ever since. So breathing dysfunction, but also breathing, enhancing your performance in sport through breathing and looking at that respiratory building block that so many sports people don't do.
So if I was to go, for instance, and search on PubMed or Google Scholar and look up breathing patterns, healthy individuals, exercise, I'd find very little, right?
Likely very little. And there's been a lot of traction, I think, obviously in our post-COVID as well, into that breathing world and breathing space. But the research is definitely heating up a little bit more now in terms of how one should breathe. There's a lot in terms of what you can do to improve your breathing in terms of training the muscles of inspiration. There's a lot on that done by certain devices in different sports, rowing, running, and cycling. And there you'll find quite a bit of evidence. But the breathing dysfunction in the research is more limited to the world of where there's an underlying lung pathology at this point, and then in healthy individuals with what we call breathing pattern disorders.
Describe what a breathing pattern disorder is. I mean, what is bad breathing? Before we get into good breathing.
Yeah. So you'll have a look at a person who's breathing in a dysfunctional way, or person that's been diagnosed with a breathing pattern disorder. And it's a term given to a collection of conditions where there's been a biomechanical or biochemical change in the way someone breathes. So their biomechanics is how their chest shape is, the pattern that they use to breathe. Is it up top? Is it at the bottom? And then biochemistry, the way that you breathe, it changes the composition in the blood. So how much oxygen and how much carbon dioxide there is. And when you breathe in a certain way, you can really alter that biochemistry. And if you get to that point and you really reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the blood, you can elicit symptoms of chest pain, breathlessness, tingling in the fingers, heart palpitations, just through bad breathing. And then we would call it a breathing pattern disorder when it affects your metabolism or your biochemistry in that way. Dysfunctional breathing doesn't always have to induce a biochemical change, but it's more just the pattern that you're using to breathe. We won't say it's right or wrong, because I don't like to say there's a right or wrong way to breathe, but let's say there's a more efficient way to breathe. And if there's someone that's breathing dysfunctionally, that can be optimized. Breathing pattern disorder takes a bit of work. The terminology is still sticky, but that's how I would decipher between the two.
Would it be helpful to try and go from very basic principles and say that we breathe under the direction of our brains to regulate carbon dioxide and oxygen? Is that accurate?
Yes.
So when carbon dioxide levels rise, there are centers in the brain that cause us to breathe in because it's necessary for survival. And we then expire or exhale carbon dioxide, and that lowers the CO2 levels, and we kind of defend homeostasis. And there's almost like an acid-base balance, and there's a CO2 level. Why would an athlete not just do that well naturally?
So I think it all starts with, I think we're all very inclined to look at how an athlete breathes when they're doing their sport of choice, right? But we're not looking at how they breathe at rest. And if you're not breathing optimally at rest, it is going to a certain extent, compromise the way that you breathe and how you feel when you do your performance breathing, if we want to call it that. So an athlete, you will naturally change the way that you breathe in response to exercise. You'll start to breathe a lot quicker, and there's certain processes that happen naturally. And a lot of athletes might get away with it. But a lot of athletes might feel that there are these respiratory symptoms that are uncomfortable. And a lot of the time they'll attribute to, well, I'm deconditioned, I'm unfit, or, you know, it's just the way that I breathe.
That's definitely the case. Yeah. We all do, right? Nobody.
The point is, I don't know if I'm breathing badly or not.
Nobody listening to this goes through a month of exercise and doesn't at some point feel like, I wish I could breathe better.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely, yeah.
So what makes
unless you don't know there's any way that you can breathe better.
Yeah, and so if anything comes out of this discussion, it's awareness that you can breathe more optimally than you do. Yeah.
And that's 100% what we're after, is awareness of breathing in sport.
Okay, so I cycled on Sunday with a little guy that's fitter than I am, and every climb I was hanging off the back and couldn't breathe. So I come to you now and I say, I think I might have breathing issues. What do you do with me?
So we'll first start with doing a basic breathing assessment. And the more you think about breathing and the more you read about it, the breathing, as we like to call it, rabbit hole, gets really, really deep. I mean, the physiology goes on. But what we like to do is keep it really simple. So we'll start with a basic assessment of breathing and just talk to you about exactly what it is that you felt. Because often athletes will report these respiratory symptoms that are fleeting in nature, maybe at the peak of their exercise, right at the top of their heel. They'll have these really uncomfortable symptoms, a tight chest, wheezing, coughing, shortness of breath. Maybe that shortness of breath, though, is disproportionate to what they are doing. So maybe they're so breathless at a point in the trail, a point on the cycle, that they shouldn't be so breathless. So those are the kind of, that's the kind of fishing that we would do. Because, I mean, one in four endurance athletes are likely to have symptoms of asthma. So asthma-like symptoms. I mean, one in four, it's
25%.
But hang on. Well, my ears prick up because when you say symptoms of asthma or asthma-like symptoms, I gather that means you don't think they're all asthma.
Yeah.
What are they then, if not asthma?
So if one is to look at the sort of factors that would respiratory limitations to an athlete, right, we'll typically look at about four components. So the first component would be breathlessness, looking at a dysfunctional breathing pattern. How are you breathing? Where are you breathing? Is it efficient? The second one will be airflow limitations. So does a patient have exercise-induced bronchoconstriction? So when you exercise, do your lungs tighten? Does your chest tighten? Or do you have symptoms of something that's also really underdiagnosed? It's a principle called ILO, which is exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction, where your throat pulls tight. So is there an airflow limitation that's causing your performance limitation? The third one is exercise-induced arterial hypoxemia, which we won't get too tucked into now. And then the fourth one, which I think will be relevant for this, is respiratory muscle fatigue.
Yeah.
So your breathing muscles are getting tired. And now we want to try and find out which box you fit into.
Could be many of them.
Could be many of them, and they could all overlap. Absolutely.
So with you, we would start. And some of them are inevitable. I mean,
that's the challenge.
You're breathing heavy because you're putting in an effort.
Yeah, I'm 320 watts. Of course, I'm breathing hard.
Yeah exactly.
Yeah.
So how do you test? In other words, do you use a flow meter and that sort of thing? How do you test whether somebody could be better at breathing?
So first of all, we'll go over the basic assessment, assessing where they breathe, how quickly they breathe, and I can go over that with you so basically I'd start with you come in and see me. We'll have a chat about your ride that was a bit challenging, and we'll explore any symptoms that you felt were maybe not warranted by the hill. You know, you shouldn't have felt that bad cycling up a hill. So, and if the listeners want to kind of tick off these boxes as well, it might be helpful.
Yeah,
so
that's great.
The first thing, breathing, we want to look at breathing at rest before we look at your performance breathing. So in a seated position, your breathing should be quiet and relaxed. At rest, you should not be able to hear yourself breathing, right? The second thing, it should be smooth.
Inhalation or exhalation or both?
Both.
And if it's a problem, is it more likely to present on one side of the breathing equation or the other? Or is it equal?
It can be. So it depends on a lot of patients. My findings on exhale, that's usually where the noisiness will.
And presumably I should be breathing in through the nose and out through the mouth.
So we'll get to that now as well. Yeah.
Okay. One step at a time.
The eyebrows were going higher and higher. Hang on, I'm saying something wrong here. implicating myself, which is good.
The second one will be your breathing should be smooth and rhythmic. So each breath wave in and out should be reproducible. It should be equal. There shouldn't be any erraticness to your breathing. You shouldn't take these big sighs.
Every
you shouldn't be
two.
Yawning. Breathing should be smooth and rhythmic. Then breathing at rest should ideally be in and out through the nose. So that's one of the big ones. And if a patient is a chronic mouth breather, that's a big place that we can, where the patient can really benefit quite a bit from just changing to nasal-only breathing at rest. But we'll get stuck into that now because that is not easy for all people.
Why does it develop in the first place? Or do you want to put that in the parking lot and come back to it?
What's that?
The fact that some people breathe through the mouth when they could breathe through the nose breathe through the nose. Like, it feels like a bad habit maybe that gets developed?
It can be.
Or is there a structural thing that drives it?
So sometimes structural. So guys with deviated septums, chronic sinusitis, allergies, nasal congestion, they're going to deviate to the mouth, and then that just becomes the way that they breathe if they don't address the nasal issues. The guys with the deviated septums, that's, you know, then we often refer them to an ENT for further help. But the nasal congestion, we try and sort out as far as possible, or refer them on to someone who can do it better, like an ENT or a pulmonologist or someone like that. But your point on why does that change? Often, you know, everyone is born breathing correctly. You know, it's our kind of inherent right to breathe well.
Yeah.
And it's really become challenged by modern society. So our breathing changes and it's so subject to change from thoughts, feelings, emotions, stress. And we lead these chronically busy lives, right? So we wake up, we quickly try and fit a training session in, we go and work a full work day, we come home, some to kids, work after hours, you don't really sleep well, but there's also got to be food somewhere, and we wake up the next day and do it all again. So we're rushing all the time. We're just addicted to being busy. And sometimes our breathing changes to match this. So when we shift metabolic gears in response to a cold or a virus or something like that, it's normal for our breathing to change to match this, right? What's not normal is when the breathing doesn't come back down after that threat is gone and you're still breathing in response to this threat that's no longer there. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
But and also the way that we sit. So there's a theory or a hypothesis that when we're at school and we start sitting in desks and we stop playing and moving as much, that breathing also changes in response to this.
Okay.
But our jobs, lives, stress is a big one for breathing.
Very linked, because if we talk about people who want to, if you look at all these apps at the moment and you can go onto them and you can take 5 deep breaths and you can feel a bit calmer, because it has an emotional effect on your body when you're breathing slow. Even just the act of breathing slow actually has an amazing effect on your body as a rule.
Hugely.
Yeah.
And it touches on, exactly what you were saying, just that calmer feeling.
Mm.
And by breathing slowly, you stimulate that parasympathetic nervous system, that rest and digest side of things, as opposed to stimulating that sympathetic nervous system that prepares for fight and flight and is really excited when you're breathing quickly and all over the show, because then you're so sympathetically dominant. But slow your breathing down and upregulate or increase that parasympathetic tone, it just calms all the systems and it calms you as well, reduces anxiety.
So breathing
anxiety.
Has an effect on your whole body.
Huge.
Both ways.
Huge. Yeah. So you can't think yourself into a parasympathetic state, but we say that you can breathe yourself there. Because breathing is this autonomic function, and it's the only autonomic function that we have voluntary control over should we wish to take it. So I can control my breathing now.
Yeah.
But then I can let it go. My breathing autopilot will take over. You can't do that to your heartbeat. You can't do that to your digestive system. So by taking control of your breathing at more regular moments or macro moments during the day can just help downregulate, especially if you lead an exceptionally stressful life.
And at the extremes, you see panic attack. The solution is breathe. The Absolutely. Thing you get a hold of is your breathing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Not always easy when when those panic attacks. Yeah, and often one will find that there's issues at a biochemistry level, really, really reduced CO2 levels, because they typically breathe really quickly. To try and correct that is often difficult, but it's 100% through breathing, slowing it down.
Okay.
Yeah. So you've done the assessment.
We took you off from the deviation halfway through the assessment, right?
So we were, should be in and out through the nose, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Then when you breathe, if you're close to a mirror, it's always good to have a look in the mirror. And what we then do is we do the high-low test. So we put one hand on the upper chest. So the patient will put one hand upper chest, one hand just above the belly button, relax the elbows. And then the patient, it's ideal for them to try and feel where they're breathing, because our breathing proprioception is so bad. We think we know where we breathe in, but a lot of the times our patients will say, no, the bottom hand is moving, but they're so apically dominant with that top hand moving 100% and the diaphragm's only moving up, or the bottom hand's only moving up because the top hand is pulling it there. Put them in front of the mirror for that visual feedback and they're like, oh, actually my top hand is moving more.
So you've got to be standing when you do that, aren't you?
So we test in lying flat on your back, in sitting and in standing, because your pattern changes the more weight bearing you become. So often you'll find that when you're lying flat on your back, it's easier for the bottom hand to move. Sitting, a little bit more difficult. Standing, often patients, if they have a dysfunctional breathing pattern, will be quite what we call apically dominant in standing. So ideally, when you breathe, your shoulders should move and there should be no accessory muscle use. So accessory muscles are those muscles around the neck. So you should see no activation there. You should see no vertical rise of the shoulders. So you don't want to get taller when you breathe, you want to get wider. So that's where you want to feel that movement is in that lateral space, lateral ribs, to the front, to the sides and to the back. This 360 degree motion as your diaphragm is expanding and relaxing.
Since we're not videoing this, but Ross has got his hand on his chest and on his belly. Do you know, can you feel which part of your body you're breathing with?
I'd say it's equally distributed. My right hand is on my sternum, just above.
Yeah.
My left hand is on my stomach.
Okay. And what do you feel?
I feel both roughly equally.
Okay, so you give
and
them.
I have a- to, and I have to consciously, when you said I should feel the bottom, then I made an effort. Yeah. Now I can say.
So typically we don't tell the patients that before the time.
So that's the problem, yeah. So now I can say it's 80-20. Okay. And as I breathe in, I feel the bottom hand. But certainly there's also action at the top here.
Okay. Yeah. And if you stand, you might feel that that action at the top might become a little bit more and it might be more difficult for you to correct.
Yeah.
Hop on your bike and what happens then?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, I'll be aware of it next time.
It gets worse for sure.
Yeah. So this is a sort of a micro example of what you should be feeling, but what you're doing is extrapolating that during various phases of stress from walking fast to exercising hard. In other words, what should you be feeling? In other words, if you're breathing, I mean, why would you breathe with your stomach? Or are you breathing with your stomach? What should you be doing?
That's where it should be. I mean, you should be breathing right to the bottom. You talk about apically as an apex of the lungs, right?
So apex, So when we refer to apical breathing, it's upper chest movement, which is what we don't want to see. Your upper chest will move slightly, but it should fire second. So you should have movement at the diaphragm first because it's your main muscle of inspiration. As the lungs fill, then you'll get slight chest movement, but it should certainly not be activating first. And why you want to feel, and we don't say the lower part of the stomach, it's typically above the belly button, along the lower parts of your ribs that you'll feel if you put your hands on your side, you want to feel them moving laterally, anteriorly, and posteriorly.
Is the expansion of the diaphragm?
That's the expansion of the diaphragm. That's where you're filling up with air. So typically not, and I know a lot of people love the term belly breathing, but through work I found that it's really misunderstood because you can stand and push out your stomach, but you're certainly not breathing there. You're just using your muscles to push it in and out.
Yes.
So I feel patients misunderstand that when they read that on the internet. Often they'll come in and they say, look, I'm breathing through my belly, and you're like, no, those are your muscles. You're actually not breathing at all. You're holding your breath. So to just change that narrative and teach them how and where, but diaphragm certainly.
So for the benefit of the listeners, what Sam's doing now is you're putting your hands on your base of your ribs, basically.
Yeah, you can even put them right a little bit bottom, onto those ribs onto the as well. Ribs. Yeah.
And then the movement she's just shown us is that as she breathed in, her hands kind of open out.
So horizontal.
It's almost like if you had wings now, my wings are flapping backwards. That's what the movement I'm looking at is.
You should typically see movement laterally, but also if I put my hands to the front and the back, you should also feel movement to the front and then to the back as well.
That's the 360 degree thing you spoke about. 360 degree,
filling from the bottom to the top instead of... And if you both had to take a breath in through your nose versus a breath in through your mouth, you can feel, you should be able to feel how that distribution of airflow changes, right? So in through the mouth is short, sharp, almost always into that upper chest, but a breath through the nose almost goes deeper and wider is what patients have reported when we asked how it feels.
Yeah, that short, sharp cue is interesting because I feel like if I wanted to fill it from the bottom up, I'd have to breathe in for about 4 or 5 seconds. That would be my timing thought, right?
Yeah.
Like, okay, now it's done. 3 seconds. And is that something then when I'm exercising that you'd want to be aware of is to actually, you almost want to slow down the breathing. The force of inhalation has to be modulated in order to get the timing long. Am I making sense?
Yes, absolutely. So with exercise, we try and get the guys to focus on slowing the respiratory rate first. So you want to increase the volume before you increase the frequency of breathing. So we want to keep guys away from that, right? So you rather, and which we'll go into some breathing techniques now as well, but if you can try and slow down that breathing, obviously without impacting performance, we're not looking for quiet and relaxed breathing while you're doing your sport. Obviously things will get pretty noisy then. It's more than about the efficiency. So you won't typically go for overventilating the lung and filling it up as much as possible, but you're going to go a little bit deeper than tidal volume, which is the way that we breathe in now, sort of 500 mils in and out, nice and easy, slow. Someone shouldn't really be able to see you breathe. And that's one of the other steps that we'd have a look at when we're assessing how someone should breathe, in addition to how quickly that person is breathing. So how quickly do you breathe in a minute? And what do you guys think normal is? How quickly should someone be breathing?
Number of breaths per minute.
Number of breaths per minute.
At rest or exercise?
At rest. So I would say it's close to what a heart rate would be, 60 to 70 breaths per minute.
No, I'd say 12. I mean, you want to be breathing once every 5 seconds, I'd have thought.
Yeah. So about 8 to 12 is normal breaths.
When you're now Chapman's Peak trying to hang on, then it's 60. Because now you're hyperventilating big time. Sure.
So if you 60 breaths per minute.
A breath would be an inhale and an exhale.
Inhale and an exhale.
Yeah. So you're talking a rhythm of 3.5 seconds in, 3.5 seconds out kind of thing,
Yeah, something along those lines. So we measure how quickly someone is breathing. So someone coming into the clinic breathing 12 breaths a minute versus someone breathing 60 breaths a minute, that person is going to look very different. And obviously you think that's the foundation they're creating. Now they're going to go and exercise off of 60 breaths a minute. You know, the only way you can go from there is up, you know, and that just becomes really inefficient really quickly. So a lot of the guys coming in are at about 30 breaths a minute, and that's just someone working really hard. Really quickly taking these big erratic sighs. And then what we'll also look for in the last sort of tick box that you can have a look at is the exhale should be passive. So you work on the inhale, it's an active process, and then the exhale should be this passive recoil of the lungs. So if you put your hand on your stomach, you shouldn't feel any activity underneath that hand. So when you're exhaling, it's just nice and easy and relaxed. This will change during exercise, but you certainly shouldn't be working that hard when you're sitting still. And that's kind of what we'd look at and what one can tick off. And then in addition to that, we'd have a look at actual objective measures and sort of put those in to where you are for your, in relation to your age predicted norm. So I test your diaphragm strength, but I look at your height, age, weight, and gender to see where you should be. And that gives me an idea of, are you above or below your age predicted norm?
How do you test diaphragm strength?
Yeah, so that's, so we do something called a MIP, so maximum inspiratory pressure, or PI max, and that's your maximal inhale against a resistance. So it's a small device that we use. Your patient will exhale everything, so they'll empty the lungs, put the lips over the device, and then they'll suck in as hard and as fast as they can. So we'll measure the strength of the diaphragm, also the contractility of the diaphragm, so how quickly can it contract, having a look at the peak inspiratory flow and the volume that they then inhale, and then have a look at their peak expiratory flow as well. So how happy are they to let go of the air? And in patients with asthma or any kind of bronchoconstriction obstructive patterns, they're not going to really want to let go of that air, and we'll see it in their peak expiratory flow. It'll be significantly reduced.
Is that FEV1?
So
other metrics as well.
We look at specifically just the peak expiratory flow. So if the pulmonologist will do spirometry, the lung function tests on their computers, and they'll be able to look at the full FEV1 on a digital curve. We just do the basic peak expiratory flows to see how much air, how many liters per minute you're able to get rid of.
And you can see from those tests whether somebody has a problem or not.
We can see quite nicely. And then we'll kind of put that together. And we measure rib angle as well. So the sort of angle, or the degree between your ribs. If someone is quite hyperinflated and not really letting go of that air, they'll have quite a big rib angle, and that'll go together with a high or a reduced peak expiratory flow, maybe a little bit breathless because they're kind of breath stacking, which gets worse on performance as well.
Now, in the absence of pathology, how many people, what's the prevalence of abnormalities or dysfunction that you typically notice in any of these assessments?
So the awareness is not great.
Yeah, 100% lacking awareness.
So athletes, like, again, don't know that there's help. And we've seen a lot of athletes who are struggling post-COVID, but that now is in response to a pathology. Right. So they had COVID and they were really not symptomatic, went back to doing their thing maybe a little bit too quickly, and now they're kind of having this shortness of breath maybe 2 months after infection.
And that's so. I don't want to self-diagnose and come across like a hypochondriac, but I feel like I might be in that boat. But with COVID now, are you seeing habits that have been formed through COVID that then persist beyond it, or are you seeing direct effects of COVID on the breathing system even still? Which is it?
So I think post-COVID, your system stays in a sympathetically dominant state. So everything is on high alert. So everything's working harder, breathing as well. So habits are formed.
Right.
We're assuming post-COVID. We also don't know because we never saw that athlete prior to COVID.
So how were they?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So what was their baseline prior to that infection? But certainly what we've seen is what we call dynamic hyperinflation. So these big lungs, breath stacking, holding onto the air, and really short of breath a lot sooner. Disproportionate breathlessness is what we call it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we've seen in our guys. Okay. And then athletes who just want to perform better, they've heard about things and they're just looking for that 1% edge, because everyone's doing, and this is feedback from a client as well, performing at an elite level, everyone's doing the same thing, right? Everyone's doing their sprint and their strength training and their conditioning and their rehab. So everyone's looking for that 1% edge where they can be even that 1% better than their competition, because on game day, that's what matters. So that's one of the big things.
I mean, you've given us a sort of the passive breathing and how it should be. Now, if we extrapolate that into an active either a rugby match or a cycle or something like that.
A bike ride.
Talk us through good breathing habits in those situations when you're under stress.
Performance stress from your sport.
In other words, when you are breathing heavily, have we missed a step?
Maybe we've missed a step and you want to do a little intermediate, but we've spoken rest.
Is there a walking step? In other words,
this is good.
You walk and then you run and then you sprint and then you cycle with Ross.
And then Cam after that.
So you can definitely. So one of the things that we encourage our athletes who come and see us, look, it depends on the sport as well. Someone playing sevens rugby versus someone doing endurance long runs where they are able to go a lot slower, it's going to be a little bit different per person. But let's say you're able to go a little bit slower, you're happy with that. We'll try and get them to use what we call the breathing gears. So like you have gears in a car, and you would change those gears depending on the demands of the road. We try and raise awareness that breathing is the same. So as soon as you go out your door, your heart rate hasn't even done anything yet and your mouth is open. We're ready to go. We try and encourage a step or two back, right? So if you have worked at nasal breathing and you're quite efficient breathing through your nose at rest, if you're starting off nice and slow, try and stay breathing through your nose. This is something that's not for everyone, and it is certainly something, if you practice it, you will get better. The first little bit is not so easy.
So just to take a step back, and I'm just make sure I'm understanding you correctly, the reason why you're encouraging people to breathe through the nose is because nose breathing gives you a deeper breath.
So it gives you a deeper breath. Right. Breathing in through your nose, there's also slight resistance, so it automatically activates your diaphragm, which is your main muscle of breathing. But more importantly, it also warms, humidifies, and filters the air. So you filtering what the environment is giving you, pollution, pollen, all of those things, right? So it's actually a first line of defense. Also breathing through your nose, you inhale what we call nasal nitric oxide. So it's what we manufacture in our paranasal sinuses, and it's a potent vasodilator. So you breathe it in, it opens everything up. So it's a massive opening, like a bronchodilator almost for the airways.
So in other words, if you go straight into mouth breathing, you're kind of bypassing that.
You're bypassing the benefits of that, and also hitting mouth breathing before you need to, before you got to the hard part, the hills, etc. So you mouth breathing before you actually need to.
Yeah.
That's more the idea around that as well.
So then you've got nowhere to go when you do need
it. You've got nowhere to go.
You mentioned something to me even in preparation for this about laryngeal obstruction or occlusion or something.
Yes, the ILO. So exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction.
And that's with mouth breathing?
So it's certainly mouth breathing certainly doesn't help, but there's this abnormal closure of the vocal folds. So they're not opening as they should. Okay. And a lot of patients are diagnosed with asthma when they have this, but actually it's a throat closure thing and the laryngeal muscles not talking to the diaphragm and also closing. So at peak exercise, they get this, can't breathe, but as soon as they stop, it goes away as soon as the muscles settle, which is very different to asthma. So mouth breathing certainly won't help these guys. So in our ILO patients, we certainly encourage nasal breathing at rest, start of sport. And then before you get to mouth breathing, there's this bridge that no one really does, is that nose in, mouth out. So you can even do nose in per slip. So it's not a dumping of the air, not a dumping of that carbon dioxide, like, but instead. And the more you practice that, you can develop a skill in that sort of breathing space, and you can get better at using it. Usually it's the breathing gear that the guys struggle with the most. Even if you do two or three breaths there, it's still a bridge before you get to mouth breathing. And the thing you can add to mouth breathing is that purslipped exhale again. So you're trying to stay away from that hyperventilation and you... And this way, in that same way that you would up gear from nose, 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 mouth, 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 when you are finished with your heel and you get to like a long, cruisy downhill, down gear in that same way. So you don't need to be huffing and puffing through your mouth, because then you get to that hill, huffing and puffing, you got nothing. I mean, exactly. And
you're enforcing some sort of pacing here, aren't you?
Yeah.
To some extent.
So...
I mean, I never enjoyed respiratory physiology when I was a student. I just, for some reason, I just couldn't.
I don't know why, because I'm finding it quite fascinating.
Well, I mean, this is.
Good thing for me, because respiratory physiology is tough.
They clearly taught me the wrong stuff. I mean, I remember like being totally switched off all that like curves and whatever else. But in my simplistic understanding, I would have thought that the mouth-nose combination increases the available area and therefore the resistance goes down. That's why we go to the mouth in the first place, right?
Yeah.
So is that not the case? I was struck by something you said where some resistance actually activates the diaphragm. So in actual fact, counterintuitively, you want there to be more resistance.
Slight resistance to cause that diaphragm to activate because it's our main muscle of inspiration. Mm. And you can feel that if in a person with a breathing pattern disorder who's quite apically dominant, if you're breathing in through the mouth, you're not getting that diaphragm activation. So you're just pounding all of that air into that upper chest, causing dehydration of the throat, a lot of irritation, inflammation, discomfort, etc. So what the pursed-lip breathing does is it also gives sort of a back pressure as well, which prevents the lungs from collapsing. Yeah. And it kind of prolongs that exhale. Even if it's for a second or two longer, it certainly makes a difference in your rate of perceived exertion.
When I'm moving through the gears, it's nose, nose, in, out. Nose, mouth, in, out. Then mouth, mouth. Is it possible to breathe nose and mouth at the same time, or does the one switch the other one off? Like, I'm just trying to think now. Like, I'm just gasping. You're looking for everything, the fifth gear, aren't you? Everything that I can. I mean, it's desperate times now, I'm just breathing in as much as I can. Is it all mouth or all nose, or can I get both at the same time?
I think one is going to dominate. Yeah. So I think you're maybe going to get like an 80-20. Right. Probably the mouth is going to want to pull more.
Okay.
But the thing is even if you really focus on where you're breathing and you can stay in a good pattern when you are operating at your limit, you can be in an efficient respiratory pattern and not apically dominant. So you can be working through that diaphragm. Because what a lot of people also don't think about is that the respiratory muscles, they also get tired. So we think about our quads and our calves and we train them, but they don't think about the respiratory muscle fatigue. So these poor lungs, especially on an endurance ride or an endurance run, they're having to ventilate you for several hours, move air in and move air out. And the diaphragm is quite a fatigue-resistant muscle, but it will get to a point if you had to test diaphragm strength and endurance pre- and post-event. Mm. There's going to be a reduction in the pressure-generating capacity of that muscle. So they say about 10 to 15%. So what that can do for an athlete is the first thing, it's going to prevent you from getting to your maximal ventilation, right? Which in endurance is fine. You don't really need to go there. But the second thing that inspiratory muscle fatigue can induce is this activation of the respiratory metabolic reflex. So that's essentially what happens when the inspiratory muscles get tired. They redistribute cardiac output or blood flow. So it's essentially a blood stealing phenomenon. So they steal blood or redirect blood flow from the limb locomotor muscle. If you're rowing, it's your arms. If you're cycling, running, it's your legs. They steal the blood from the legs because they're tired. Mm-hmm. Not good. Mm-hmm. Leads to premature fatigue of your leg muscles, which can directly impact performance. So it can negatively impact performance.
Mm.
The respiratory metabolic reflex, it's not necessarily something that always happens when your lungs get tired. Respiratory muscle fatigue, we know that it's there. Does it always activate this reflex? No, but in short, sharp bursts, it could potentially do that. And if you have premature leg fatigue, not really good for you if you've still got quite a far way to go.
Mm.
And it's so interesting. And by doing something like inspiratory muscle training, making that muscle stronger, you build in a bit of a buffer, protective effect with that. Can you delay or you attenuate this reflex, which is also quite a big thing in sport. And helpful.
What's interesting is you mentioned that you've been involved in rugby, so that's obviously a different sport. And we did a podcast a couple of weeks ago talking about the best position to be in when you want to recover between hard sessions, being the hands and the knees research there. But what's different from those short, sharp accelerations and the kind of exercises and the breathing that they need to do there versus an endurance athlete?
I think the endurance athlete has more time. The short, sharp stuff, the really intense stuff, you can apply the same principles. You're going to get your maximum mouth breathing quickly, and that's quite fine. But for those guys to really focus on down gearing when they can, if they have a brief moment, it is really helpful, even in 15s rugby. So if they're walking back and the guy is, they're going to convert or there's a line out and you're not involved, downregulate your breathing. And you've got moments to quickly work through the gears before you've got to go again.
It's about recovery, isn't it?
About recovery. I suppose
even if you are in the line out, you've got 30 seconds to walk to it.
Exactly.
And you're about to be involved, you best use the opportunity.
Yeah, it makes a very, very big difference.
If you watch much sevens now, rugby, you'll see at halftime, most of the teams are doing it now. The South African sevens team was the first to do it, where the coach comes into the huddle. They've got 2 minutes, right, in sevens to turn around at halftime. And instead of talking for 2 minutes and making the most of it, they actually will spend 10, 15 seconds breathing before the first instruction from the coach. And that was you.
Yeah, I hope so. I know that they did it before. So yeah. They did a breath in and out, and we just kind of tweaked it to try through the nose in and I guess it's almost like a physiological sigh on the exhale. Yeah.
And the principle was the coach can come in there and give you instructions, but nothing's going in for the first 15 seconds because there's
you're in a haze.
You're just in a high intensity exercise induced stupor.
Yeah.
And you got to get a grip before anything useful can be said.
And that's the whole thing. If you work with your breathing, you can access logical thinking and reasoning. You can play smart rugby or you can play smart sport. But if you're breathing all over the show, you can't access that next step, that logical movement forward or where should I pass. If you're all over the show, you know, you're not really thinking clearly. Mm. I think it was 15s rugby, and it's so interesting to watch the fly half or whatever convert. And it's always, they've all got their little routines that they do, right? And obviously, I always have a look from a respiratory nerd side of things. But Quade Cooper was very specific when in one of his kicks, and he would stop, purposefully close his mouth, inhale through the nose, and he'd do this like a physiological sigh out, almost to calm the jets, upregulate that sort of parasympathetic tone. And it was pretty cool to watch that it was a really purposeful action, and he did that with every single kick.
Mm.
And you can't tell me that there's not something there. Mm. I mean, his kicks are brilliant, but I'd like to sense the breathing. But
so would you say that if I look at all fly halves kicking penalties, they all take a moment to breathe. So they're probably doing that subconsciously anyway. But in that case, was he somebody that you saw helped through being more aware of what he was doing?
It certainly looked that way.
Mm.
And if you think about when you breathe well, diaphragm has a massive role in postural stabilization, balance, movement. So if you're breathing well, you get to access that. If you are all over the show breathing through your mouth, you miss out on the potential of better balance, better stability, accuracy. I think there's definitely something there that it would be helpful to pay attention to something like that.
Mm. Can you adjust? I mean, I've read about this and seen some dodgy adverts on social media around this, but can you subconsciously change the way you breathe? I know that people often, they become mouth breathers when they sleep. And I've read that you can change the way you breathe when you sleep. That doesn't seem possible because the exercises you're talking about are conscious.
Yeah. So what the exercises we initially encourage are conscious, but the aim is to condition what I call your breathing autopilot. So when you're not thinking about it, your subconscious breathing, you're breathing during sleep moments when you're looking, you know, things on your laptop, that you're breathing well. So initially that takes a lot of awareness, a lot of sort of conscious effort, but the more that becomes your breathing autopilot, your go-to pattern, you should breathe that way. Some people still struggle to breathe. A lot of the time it's a chicken egg scenario. Am I breathing badly in the day because I breathe badly at night, or vice versa? But if you're breathing well during the day at rest, you should be breathing that same way at night. You've probably read on social media about things like mouth taping and things like that to encourage nasal breathing. It's a bit daunting for a lot of people. And that's not like, just disclaimer, it's not like duct tape across the mouth.
I can just see Hannibal Lecter there, you know?
It's just a small piece of vertical micropore, so that should your lips want to open, they can. You're not like, and this should only be encouraged.
So it is a thing then that you can...
It is a thing, certainly. I've tried it as well.
Have you?
And actually, you wake up feeling a lot more energized and much better sleep, much deeper sleep. But I would only encourage something, even thinking about something like that, if your daytime breathing is optimal and good. You definitely don't do this if you hate breathing through your nose or if you can't breathe through your nose. So some people will say on this podcast, okay, cool, breathe through your nose at rest. And some people can't. They feel this air hunger.
You feel like you're slightly under inhaling. Yeah.
Absolutely. And they feel this need to take a catch-up breath. And that's because they're very uncomfortable with this now sudden increase of carbon dioxide in the system because they're used to mouth breathing. They're used to getting rid of it. Now you're closing your mouth and there's that buildup of carbon dioxide. And this air hunger is not because there's a reduction in oxygen. You're not being deprived of oxygen, but you're sensitive to that CO2 buildup because that's our stimulus to breathe. And then they'll want to take this big breath. So sometimes it's a process to get your nose only breathing. And then we'll do the nose in pursed lips and move them over slowly. And it's interesting then to measure their end-tidal CO2. So see how much carbon dioxide they have in their blood as a biofeedback tool to them as well.
So when you say that, and I get that because I've tried to do nose breathing myself, probably not to an extent where I've really tried hard enough. But I do feel like every breath you're doing, you're like 5% short of what I should bring in. But in theory, in a normal, healthy human being, should you be able to teach yourself, you should be able to bring in enough oxygen if you're breathing in through your nose and exhaling through your mouth. It's Definitely. Just a case of practicing. It's not that you're physiologically, you're not possible. It's not possible to do it.
No, it's definitely possible. And it also, a lot of us are used to large volume breaths. So through the nose and a smaller tidal volume, it's a smaller volume breath. And we don't like that. We've kind of set a normal biochemistry. So your body is used to or established, like you said earlier, a homeostasis that's normal for you. And as soon as you deviate from that normal, it's going to say, hey, take a quick breath out, you know, let's get back to normal. So it's absolutely possible. And there's a really great, there's nice breathing retraining exercises that one can do that you'd start on your back and just start with slow nasal breathing or nose in pursed lips for 10 minutes twice a day to retrain the respiratory center in the brain to breathe in a different way. Like a computer, if you don't change the input, the output's never going to change. So that's super helpful as well.
I suppose people who snore, they suffer from that, don't they? So they can potentially even solve that problem.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of the time to look at their, because also breathing has a lot to do with tongue posture as well. So if you breathe through your mouth, your tongue is lying flat and low tone bottom of your mouth. If you are breathing through your nose, it lifts. And that's got a lot to do with... with sleep hygiene as well. And that's definitely a whole sort of sphere that one can look at for sure.
Is the ability to hold a conversation during exercise an accurate or valid guide to whether I'm over breathing or not?
It's good. The talk test, absolutely, to see if you can. It's a good sign.
But this is a talk test in the other direction, because normally the talk test, you'd know this, right, Mike?
Yeah,
a lot. If you want to be sure you're exercising at a low enough intensity on your easy days, you should be able to hold a conversation.
Yeah.
We're actually saying here that some people who have dysfunctional or abnormal breathing patterns might use that to identify that there's a problem in the first place.
Yeah, they can definitely.
Because I'm definitely aware, like if I'm riding with guys that I know are either at or slightly less, like a lesser level than I am, I hear them talking and I think, how are you guys doing that?
Yeah.
If I try to have a conversation, I'd have to slow down. So this is the other direction. It's a talk test in the other direction. You know what I mean?
In other words, you feel like you're going harder than you should, and other people behind you should be working harder or talking.
Well, the crux of this whole issue for me is like you have to hyperventilate. Your depth, your frequency breathing is going to go up, but what you're saying is, in some people, it goes up too much.
Disproportionate
response. And I'm just thinking, what is the best indication of that, so that I'm aware that I'm doing that? And maybe it's the fact that other folk can talk at this intensity and I can't.
In other words, is intensity directly linked to the amount of breaths that you need to take?
It has to be, because that's what's driving the hypercapnia, the high CO2 that's stimulating the breathing in the first instance.
So if your heart rate is 85% of its maximum, is your breathing then 85% of its maximum?
Or 95, then you've got a problem.
Or if it's 95, it's a problem. Yes.
Mm. Yeah, so usually, the harder you work, the harder you're going to breathe. And the more you focus on your breathing, the more you can. There are guys that can nasal only breathe at their maximum work rate, right? But that takes a lot of effort and it's not always easy. Yeah. But definitely, if you're cycling with guys that you are actually fitter you should be able to talk quite easily.
I mean, I remember riding with some guys and like we get to a hill and they're about to be dropped and they're having a conversation. I could not even attempt to say a word, which is interesting. I mean, I don't know whether many listeners might relate to this as well, is that some people
tactic when you go past somebody on a run or a ride.
So how are you going?
You take a deep breath before you go past them and then say, how's it and how's your day going? And then when you get out of earshot, you breathe again and it looks like you're going quite easy. So
anyway,
might be so psychological.
I just brought it up because I'm thinking a lot of people might be able to use that. I guess what I'm getting at is, are there tests one can do? Or is it just a matter of awareness and experimentation and so on to see? Like, are there any objective tests? Like, I see on my Garmin now that it tells me my breathing rate. I don't know how accurately that is. I assume it's measuring it on the chest strap. And it tells me 34 breaths a minute average, peak 55, whatever.
Yeah.
You mentioned you can measure the CO2 levels. Obviously, that's quite specialized.
Yes,
you've got to be in a lab for that.
You've got to be, mostly at rest as well. So there are specific tests that one can do also, though, in a lab. So your gold standard is your cardiopulmonary exercise test.
Are you
talking more specifically a test that you could do on a ride?
Yeah, just listeners now who are listening to this and saying, this is really interesting and I'm going to be more aware. I know what to be aware of, but I need to know if there's a problem.
Yes. So I think also with, as you were mentioning, it's important to take into account how hard you're working. Mm. So what is the goal of the ride? If it's an aerobic ride, you should be able to breathe through your nose quite comfortably, nose in or nose in, pursed lips. They do say there's a lot in the literature that says you should be able to comfortably nasal breathe when you are training aerobically.
Mm.
And that'll change the more anaerobic the ride becomes.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
suppose it depends on the guys that you're cycling with, how hard you're working, what your heart rate is, what your breathing is going to do. If it's your heart rate is low, you in your sort of aerobic zones, your breathing should match that. And if you're breathing like you are training aerobically, then try and apply the breathing gears and see if just being more mindful of how you breathe helps.
Mm. And can you... I assume that this is maybe an obvious question, is at rest, sitting in my car, driving in traffic, watching television, whatever it is, eating dinner, my awareness of breathing is, it's valuable, and I'm practicing all the time, nose breathing only now, and so on. Do those patterns then get entrenched well enough to become fixed during exercise? And how long does it take someone?
To restore their breathing pattern. Yeah. It depends. It depends how, if the dysfunction is also at a biochemical level. So if they're very symptomatic and they can't go directly to nasal breathing, that'll take longer. But basic breathing retraining, really basic, I suppose anything from 4 to 6 weeks, but that's at rest. Moving over into sport can take a little bit longer. Definitely a little bit longer than, but definitely if you focus on retraining things at rest and it looks good, then exercise shouldn't, the awareness part, it makes a huge difference. Just learning to pay attention.
Yeah.
You'll be surprised at how you might already find that it impacts performance just by regulating and thinking of working not as hard as you.
Totally. And I mean, even we confirmed you for this podcast a week ago. No doubt in the last week, just knowing this was going to happen, I'm 50 times more aware of how I'm breathing.
I will be now. But yeah, I didn't, you will know, be as well.
And it'll be interesting to see.
I'm sitting here breathing better already.
Yeah, I've caught myself three or four times.
What's interesting, I mean, this is all very good in theory, but it's, without mentioning any names, what have you seen in terms of performance from some of the people that you work with? Are there numbers that you can give? In other words, if you talk about rugby players and endurance athletes, what's the feedback?
So, yeah, there's one athlete that stands out quite, she stands out quite a bit. And I won't mention names, but she came in with queries of exercise-induced bronchoconstriction, potential asthma, potential ILO, and we worked with her quite a bit. And she's improved in her broncho test. So I think she's taken off about 23 to 30 seconds in that test, which is huge for them because how they score there determines, you know, what they're able to go on and do. Her sleep has improved, her performance has improved. They've got mics on when they are reffing. And she's not able to audibly hear herself anymore, which is a big thing for them because obviously you can always hear them on a mic. So that's improved significantly, even at altitude, which was a huge struggle in the beginning as well. But she's put in the work. She's really, really worked. And she's someone who, I often tell my athletes, recovery is so important. So breathing to aid recovery is really important. And this was a struggle for her in the beginning. But I told her, you know, you've got to calm the jets after you've had a hectic day. And you've got to do just down regulation. Your breathing. And this was huge for her. And she said how it's helped her to sleep, which was an issue for her. So sleep has improved, recovery has improved, speed on her performance test has improved, and also just her general comfort of covering quite a lot of distance during a game. And then a lot of the other guys that we've worked with are also cyclists, so they've improved in their time trial performances. A lot of these guys, I must say, we've improved their breathing, but we've also added in inspiratory muscle training. So that's like a weight training, inspiratory resistance training for these guys.
How do you do that? Yeah. How do you train and weight train?
Resistance training.
Resistance training
on the diaphragm.
Muscles. Yeah,
so it's a handheld inspiratory resistive device. So it's about the size of my palm. And you have different settings. So the better you get, the more you can tighten the coil. So that's essentially how you increase the resistance. And we'll essentially set that at about 40% of your diaphragm strength. So we'll do that test and then we'll set it at about 40% of that and then get the patient to inhale against the resistance and exhale. And they'll do
at
that
rest.
Pretty at rest.
They don't go
initially.
And sit on the bicycle and...
They can.
Yeah.
So initially they'll do that at rest, 30 breaths twice a day. The better they get, the harder we make it. And important that they do it in that correct pattern. So often you'll go online and you'll see guys with these handheld trainers and they'll be going into this upper chest. Yeah. But that's evidence-based and it is proven to reduce sort of your time trial performance. So that's what we've seen in quite a few of our cyclists and then trail runners as well have improved and placed in endurance events. And
I was going to say, I was wondering whether those devices were more of a fad, but you, as you say, there is proof that they work.
Yeah, so...
Are there different levels of, like, there'll be medical grade standard ones and then there'll be the hacked off imitations and cheap versions of them, right?
So there's one specifically that we work with. So we work with a PowerBreathe device and I'm not endorsed by them at all.
But we work
with them, and because of the research that has been done in the inspiratory muscle training field has been done with PowerBreathe. Mm. A lot of the other devices that are on the market now are kind of piggybacking off of their research. So yes, your device does do the same thing, but the research has been done with PowerBreathe. And there we do guys that are in the ICU on ventilators, we get them to do inspiratory muscle training, guys with dysfunctional breathing, even our patients with COPD. So it can be titrated according to where you are in your journey. And it's really helpful.
Now, obviously the pre-post when you do this is going to be performance for an athlete. I guess for someone in ICU, it's lung function parameters like tidal volume and so on and diaphragm strength. Away from that, what are the pre-post things that you would typically measure to know if your interventions are working in your athletes that you work with? Are there measurables that you can assess
monthly? Within spiritual muscle training specifically or just in general?
No, generally. Now, you talk about it being a 4 to 6 week rest, potentially 3 to 6 months. Is there something like a checkpoint that someone would be able to go to once a month and say, actually, I'm making progress here? Yeah. Or is it just perceptual?
So unfortunately for the athlete, it is perceptual, rate of perceived exertion, time on their different rides or their runs. So they're just feeling better. They're not feeling as symptomatic anymore. So that's a big thing for them, is a reduction in their respiratory symptoms, cough, wheeze, shortness of breath. Yeah. So that's a big one for them. From our side, objectively, we'll do all those measures that I mentioned earlier. And then we also do specific tests. So we do the shortness of breath questionnaires, ILO questionnaires, and we redo those after we've seen that there's been some improvement. And typically their scores are much less because their symptoms are a lot less.
And then
we'll reevaluate breathing pattern as well. So when they came to us, they were 80% up into the top of their chest, 20% low. When we reevaluate, the breathing pattern has normalized or has become more efficient.
Because I often wonder how much awareness drives the change as opposed to the actual interventions done off the back of awareness. In other words, if I'm going to achieve a change of arbitrarily 10 units, was 70% of that, 7 out of 10, just awareness, and the 3 out of 10 added on by your exercises and activities, or was it 3 awareness and 7 the activities? You know what I mean?
I think it's different. Awareness is huge.
Yeah.
And I think just adding that in as a treatment technique in guys that don't have bad breathing pattern disorders, that might be all that you do. Just change the way that you breathe, do this, apply this to exercise. That might be enough. But in terms of the objective and the formal respiratory measures like diaphragm strength, peak flow, diaphragm contractility, end tidal carbon dioxide, those things, awareness won't really play a part in. Those are quite objective in nature. So I think it's a mixture of both, but awareness is huge. Like you said, just by being more aware, you could shift your pattern. There's some patients who can't shift their pattern. Doesn't matter how aware they are. There's no ways that they can do that.
But to a point, right? And then beyond that, maybe I need some, or the person needs some extra support and assistance. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you think this is the kind of a new frontier in sports development? In other words, if you look at you've obviously treated some athletes, but do you kind of feel like every single sport would benefit from doing this sort of thing, and then maybe in 5 years' time, everybody who's got a whiff of being a professional sportsman will start doing this kind of training?
I think it's an important look. Like, of the three body systems that contribute most to athletic performance, right? Cardiovascular, musculoskeletal, and respiratory. Respiratory is just the least appreciated. It's just not really taken into account.
Because we just do it and we don't need to be.
Yeah, and respiratory health in athletes is just really overlooked. So I do think it warrants more attention, because especially if you look at something like respiratory tract infections, right? It's one of the most common presentations of an athlete why they go to the doctor for something other than an injury is a respiratory tract infection. And those things kind of go unnoticed. So a systemic approach of a respiratory health in athletes. I mean, there was a study done, I think 122 athletes across 12 Olympic sports. So these are like high-end elite guys. Almost half of these guys reported respiratory symptoms a year before data collection was done. And when asking these guys who had one respiratory symptom, about 80% of them did, and who had two respiratory symptoms, about 60% of them did. And that's a lot. That's things like shortness of breath, wheezing, sinonasal issues, laryngeal issues. And those are guys at the top of their game. So you can't, I find it really hard to believe that a respiratory health assessment or paying attention to your respiratory system, I mean, is not a good idea.
In other words, are you suggesting then if you're breathing better, and maybe I'm taking this a bit far, but the theory says if you're breathing in through your nose more often than you're breathing through your mouth, you're capturing a lot of allergens, as we discovered in our podcast last week with the doctor who was an allergologist.
Yes.
Talking a lot about how, you know, the mouth breathing is actually what brings in a lot of allergens into your system. So what you're saying is the more you breathe through your nose, the less likely you are to be sick.
It's a huge first line of defense. Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially the addition of the nasal nitric oxide also plays a role in that defense system as well. But I think looking at your respiratory system, aside from just improving performance, I know one just wants to look at that sort of in isolation, but I think if you think of what that can do to you controlling your daily stresses, sleeping better, I mean, we all know that those boring things all play a role in performance. They're all essentially the building blocks of performance. So if you breathe better, you do control life stresses better, you do sleep better, breathe better at rest, you're ventilating better, you're using the correct muscles. Sure. So look, my opinion, I suppose, a little bit biased as well, because we see such good results. But there's a lot of chatter. I mean, Prof. James Hull has done a lot of work. He's in the UK on respiratory health in athletes. And the findings are quite incredible from a respiratory side of things and how prevalent a lot of the symptoms are in these guys. We wouldn't really expect it. Elite guys taking part in their sort of high in sport, you'd expect them to be quite fine.
But I guess many of them have got to a high level. They're always looking for that 1%, 2% more, and potentially this is something that could give them that half a percent more, which could be the difference between winning and losing at that level. Yeah.
And even if you look at respiratory tract infections, I mean, you get sick, you're on antibiotics, you're out, you can't train, you've got to get back into it. Exactly. So if you can prevent even that, and that will have an effect on performance.
And actually, there's data. I mean, you would have seen some of the studies that if you sampled, say, 1,000 people who ran Two Oceans or a marathon or whatever, many of them developed the symptoms of having infection without an infection, simply because of the mechanical stress of breathing for 5-6 hours or 3-4 hours, quite hard. Yeah. So even controlling that aspect would be beneficial in the absence of an infection.
Definitely. And there's not big studies, but I mean your net amount of water loss, nose versus mouth breathing. So just the dehydration component from in and out through the mouth from 5 or 6 hours, all that irritation, you're breathing in whatever the environment has to offer you through your mouth, drying everything out, irritation, inflammation, there's coughing, post-nasal drip maybe, dripping down into the lungs, maybe they get a little bit sick. So it all I think plays a role for sure.
I suppose the thing is also like, what's the downside?
There's
no downside other than now I'm going to be obsessing about how I breathe for 3 hours on a bike
while
ride.
I'm just down the road.
And next time we ride together or not, now we won't be talking to each other. We'll just be breathing through our noses.
Yeah, I'm going to point out every time I hear you breathe through your mouth, I'm going to cough. I think in my mind there are some parallels to like running. You know, we don't have to learn how to run, but actually some people run badly and they have to fix some problems in order to run safely without injury and faster, right? But there's a downside to trying to change how you run, because now you become actually like overly mechanical and you don't learn to relax and so forth. But I don't see that downside here. It's similar in the idea that it's natural, you don't have to think about it, but actually you do. But there's no, I can't see it, there's no downside, so therefore try it.
Because in theory, if you train in any kind of sport, the more you do it, the better you become at it.
Unless you've got a bad habit. Well, then if you train it wrongly.
This is one element where a bad habit can stay entrenched, even no matter how much you train.
It can, and the bad habit can, and not with everyone. Mm. And this is also can be the case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know. And a lot of the guys that have the most inefficient, or we say inefficient, but funny looking running styles, they actually run amazingly.
Yeah.
That's why I said initially as well, we can't say, oh, you're breathing wrong or you're breathing wrong. It's just maybe a little bit inefficient, and let's try and make it, let's optimize it a little bit and see if we can optimize your performance through optimizing your breathing at rest and make you a little bit more comfortable so that you're not working so hard. And that's kind of the the thought behind that.
Obviously, we're going to include your contact details. You're geographically constrained in Cape Town. But if anyone listening to this wants to see you, they can do that, right, in your clinic.
Yes.
Is there an online resource where people can go and learn a little bit more about this that might be accessible to anyone anywhere in the world that you can recommend? You mentioned a clinic in New Zealand.
Yes.
What is that called again?
Yeah, the Radcliffe Breathing Group in New Zealand. So they've got quite a bit on what dysfunctional breathing is.
Okay, we'll share a link.
We'll get that from you. Definitely send that through to you as well. Yeah. So there's quite a bit of information on their site. And they've done great work in the field, and they're all physiotherapists working in the field of respiratory or muscular respiratory as well.
Is there an equivalent in the UK, North America, somewhere?
Yeah, so the thing with Radcliffe, what we do as well is we train individuals from all over the world to be able to do this. So there's level one, level two, and there's Radcliffe trained practitioners as well. So on their website, you're in UK or you're in Ireland and you want to go and have a look, contact one of them, because they'll be able, because this is not something that you learn sort of in undergrad level. It's a lot of postgrad stuff. So having a look for a Radcliffe trained practitioner, I would say, if you're concerned, and they deal with sport guys in the ICU, sort of the whole sort of spectrum.
That's great.
Well, this has been, put that in the show notes for sure.
Yeah, this has been 1,000 times more interesting than anything I learned in undergrad. That's what they should have taught me. I would have been
specialized.
I would have been a respiratory sports physiologist if we'd had this stuff instead of that other nonsense.
Sam Holzer, cardiopulmonary physiotherapist. The first time we've ever had anybody with that title at our podcast, probably the last person. But thank you very much for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating. I'm sure people who are listening to this podcast are probably breathing better already. So you'll be able to help them as well. And I think next time I go riding, it'll be interesting just to tie those methodologies. I guess it's not an overnight process. You have to train yourself.
Definitely. A skill that you need to develop. But I must say, from trying it myself, it's definitely worth investing your time. And like Ross says, you know, you've got nothing to lose and you will feel a lot more comfortable. So definitely give it a shot. Yeah. And it's been great chatting. So I've really enjoyed myself. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.